These three authors may have all come from fundamentalist backgrounds, but their stories are all different.
We will almost certainly see attempts from this administration to push us back into our closets, but I know we will fight tooth and nail to keep everything that we have won through decades of relentless activism.
Well, if gay liberation means freedom for all, a label is no liberation at all.
Welcome to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine. I'm Greg Gordon. There's no high court road to marriage equality in Northern Ireland. Three queer authors re-examined their religion and tracing the troubling Trump trail back to Orlando's Pulse. All that and more this week because you tuned in to This Way Out.
I'm Frances O'Brien.
And I'm Wenzel Jones.
With News Wrap, a summary of some of the news in or affecting LGBTQ communities around the world for the week ending August 19th, 2017. Northern Ireland's top court has ruled out a judicial road to marriage equality. Justice John O'Hara rejected two cases on August 17th at the High Court in Belfast that had challenged Northern Ireland's heterosexuals-only marriage laws, deciding that only lawmakers in the National Assembly can change them. In one case, a Northern Ireland gay couple that had legally married in London sought recognition of their marriage at home. And in the second, a lesbian couple and a gay male couple, who were each among the first to enter into less-than-equal civil partnerships when Northern Ireland created them in 2005, were asking the High Court to recognize their unions as marriages. Northern Ireland is the only major part of the United Kingdom to deny marriage equality to same-gender couples. London's Independent newspaper counted five different attempts in Northern Ireland's National Assembly to open civil marriage to gay and lesbian couples. The entrenched ruling Democratic Unionist Party has blocked all of them, and there's no sign that the government intends to change its resolute opposition.
Criticism continues in Australia over plans by the administration of Prime Minister Malcolm Turnbull to hold a voluntary, non-binding postal plebiscite on marriage equality. The Liberal Party National Party coalition government has delayed a bill to define the processes for the postal survey until Australia's High Court issues a ruling on a case they'll hear on September 5th challenging the validity of the $122 million survey. If the postal plebiscite goes forward, according to Media Access Australia, blind or vision-impaired people won't be able to vote without outside help because a braille version of the ballot or an online voting option won't be available. An estimated 275,000 blind or vision-impaired Australians of voting age could be disenfranchised.
Meanwhile, one rebel senator is circulating amendments to government legislation that include changes in the Marriage Act to open civil marriage to lesbian and gay couples. Senator Sky Kokoshi-Moore is also pushing for a free vote on the issue. I urge all parties to use this opportunity for parliamentarians to do the job we were elected to do, she said.
The Australian Bureau of Statistics, rather than the Electoral Commission, has been tasked with conducting the postal plebiscite. They're supposed to announce the results on November 15th, a week after mail-in balloting closes. But the Sydney Morning Herald reported this week that rank-and-file members of the Public Servants Union at the Statistics Bureau have grave doubts about the vote being done properly in the time frame ordered by the Turnbull government. Some call it a rush job that will not deliver an accurate picture of Australian opinion on the issue. The Community and Public Sector Union surveyed its members and found almost 3 in 4 respondents didn't think the Bureau was the proper agency to oversee the postal plebiscite. While the Bureau's boss conceded to his staff that getting the job done by November 15th will be challenging, one of his deputies dismissed the union members' concerns as representing only about 5% of the Bureau's workforce.
Elsewhere, landmark legislation to protect transgender people was introduced in the lower house of Pakistan's legislature this week. The Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Bill and the Transgender Persons Protection of Rights Criminal Law Amendment Bill would provide non-discrimination protections for the trans community and criminalize acts of violence and discrimination. Pakistan's constitution outlaws discrimination based on sex. Proponents of the legislation say that one of their goals is to expand that definition to include gender identity and expression. Physical violence against transgender people has been on the rise in Pakistan. One report documented at least 49 murders and 390 cases of physical violence against transgender people in the past 18 months. The recent widely reported brutal murder of a 17-year-old trans teenager who took the name of Mendy when she completed her transition at the age of 14 seems to have moved many to support the legislation. Sabahat Rizvi, an advocate for trans rights who's worked closely on developing the legislation, told the Washington Blade that the teen's murder has shaken all of the policymakers and mobilized the media. Pakistan's Supreme Court ruled in 2009 that transgender individuals have the right to designate themselves as third gender on official ID cards, but the government has since failed to advance that progressive decision.
Meanwhile, Joe Strauss, the Speaker of the Texas House of Representatives, foiled Governor Greg Abbott's renewed effort to pass a discriminatory bathroom bill that would have forced trans people to use sex-segregated public facilities that match their biological sex. Abbott's Republican-dominated Senate passed the bill during its regular session, but House Speaker Strauss, a more moderate Republican, expressed his strong opposition and wouldn't allow a vote in his chamber. The governor then called a special session at taxpayer expense to push through parts of his legislative agenda that didn't get approved during the regular session, and he identified the bathroom bill as his top priority. But history repeated itself this week when Strauss again blocked a vote in the House. The special session adjourned soon after the bathroom bill circled the drain. Tens of thousands of Texans spoke out against the bill during the regular and special legislative sessions, including CEOs of 27 Fortune 500 companies, nearly 500 faith leaders, and more than 50,000 people who signed petitions or testified against the measure. Abbott could push for the bill's passage again in the next legislative session.
In other news, at least three people were hospitalized in St. Petersburg with chemical burns this week after a group of nationalist skinheads used pepper spray against a group of about 100 LGBTQ people and their allies celebrating Pride in the Russian city's Field of Mars Park, which is designated as a free speech area. A dozen other Pride participants, including at least one journalist, were hurt in the melee. One of the organizers of the gathering said they were worried about such violence, but police denied their requests for protection. According to one Russian-language media report, the assaults came as the event was coming to a close, with participants lying on the grass, launching rainbow snakes into the sky, and singing songs. St. Petersburg authorities announced a few days later that they were opening a criminal investigation into the Pride assaults, but it's not known if anything will really come of that. Several of the attackers can be identified with video footage that's already been widely circulated. Organizers hailed the bravery of the Pride participants and said the city's eighth celebration of all things queer was the largest since 2010. At least one Pride participant was arrested. Lesbian activist Anna Grabatskaya was handcuffed by police for holding up a sign that read, "I love my wife." They considered that to be a violation of the country's ban on gay propaganda, for which Grabatskaya faces up to 10 days in jail.
A celebration of LGBTQ pride in Uganda has been shut down again. Organizers reluctantly canceled this week's events in and around Kampala in a statement via the Kuchu Times on August 16th, saying that going forward could have put innocent people's lives at risk. Uganda's Ethics and Integrity Minister, Simon Lokoto, directly threatened to use the police to attack and arrest anyone who dared to wave a rainbow flag. As he demonstrated last year, that was no idle threat. Police raided a kickoff Pride parade and blocked the planned 2016 march from happening. This morning, we woke up to a tirade of police surrounding the venue of the opening gala, the organizer's statement read. And later in the day, even as talks with police and other relevant authorities were ongoing, more deployment was made to the venues of the events that were to follow. Organizers vowed to continue the fight for equality. One day soon, their statement promised, "We will reap the fruits of our dedication and persistence."
And finally, advocates in Reykjavik may be pushing for the addition of one more letter to the all-inclusive alphabet soup that defines sexual and gender minority communities. They are asexuals who experience little or no sexual attraction to people of either gender. A group called Asexual Iceland marched for the first time in the city's queer pride parade on August 11th. One of the organizers said they hope to dispel many misconceptions about asexuality, an idea that's still relatively foreign to most people. Asexual Iceland might also like to see an A added to LGBTQI.
Now try it with the other I, Francis.
That's News Wrap for the week ending August 19, 2017, produced by Steve Pride, written by Greg Gordon, and recorded at the studios of KPFK Los Angeles.
Follow the news in your area and around the world. An informed community is a strong community.
News Wrap from This Way Out is brought to you by you.
Help keep us on the air and in your ears at thiswayout.org. You can also read the text of this newscast. For This Way Out, I'm Wenzel Jones.
And I'm Frances O'Brien.
In addition to the horrifying Pulse shooting, there have been a lot of upsetting changes in the past year. For me, the largest and most worrying change that occurred in the past year was our change in administration.
We'll take the pulse of queer youth under Trump later in the program. Reviewing three books on religion, This Way Out queer life and literature commentator Janet Mason sits down to drink from the silver cup, put on a straight face, and introduce us to a faithful son.
Just when I was starting to think that, well, maybe religion gets a bad rap, I was jolted back into reality by reading three recent books on the theme of religion written by queer writers. An article in the Baptist News Global cites Pew Research Center's findings that 62% of people now say homosexuality should be accepted by society. This is 12 points higher than when the same question was asked in 2007, when acceptance of homosexuality stood at 50%. That religion is changing, and so rapidly, is a good thing. We're all spiritual people, and religion does have something to offer. It can use its power to heal rather than to hurt. The first book I read was To Drink from the Silver Cup, From Faith Through Exile and Beyond, Terra Nova Books by Anna Redsand. As an adult, Redsand explored many of the same alternative spiritual traditions that have fueled me, such as yoga and the Gnostic Gospels. But since she was raised fundamentalist and encountered discrimination early on, she eventually found a Christian congregation that embraced her whole self. Redsand, who was raised by missionary parents in the Navajo Nation, is particularly insightful in her analysis of oppression. Redsand writes movingly about the alternative reality that many, especially those from religious backgrounds, experience. 21, when Stonewall happened in 1969, I was then grieving the end of a guilt-ridden clandestine affair with one of the nurses at the mission's hospital. In Straight Face, Greenbridge Press, author Brandon Wallace writes eloquently about the reality of living a dual existence as a gay person who had entered the ministry of a fundamentalist religion that denounced gays. He shows us how this is extremely unhealthy, but he also explores how he felt called to come out of the closet, become his authentic self, and help others, after he read about a gay teen who had died by suicide. While I was reading, all of my past came screaming back at me. I thought about my own suicide attempts, and all the nights I lay in bed and thought about doing the same thing. A Faithful Son is a novel by Michael Scott Garvin that explores the life of a young man growing up gay and fundamentalist in a small town in the South. Boys like me grow up crooked, he writes, and tells us the story of how and why the narrator had to leave the small town and move to Los Angeles. The narrator is devoted to his mother, and writes movingly about her final days. Ultimately, he writes not about finding faith in the end, but about the narrator finding himself. And maybe in some ways that is the same thing. These three books are a testament to difference. These three authors may have all come from fundamentalist backgrounds, but their stories are all different. What they have in common was that all three authors were raised in a strong faith that gave them something, but to preserve themselves, they had to leave. This is Janet Mason with commentary on queer life and literature for This Way Out.
Everyone thinks that I'm a freak, the way I dress, the way I speak. I'm too thin, I hate my voice. I'd switch lives if I had the choice. I'll be tall and rich someday. Everything will go my way. Someday, someday.
You don't have to be a freak, or even young, for the last year to seem fraught with challenges. A commentator from the LGBTQ Youth Outcasting radio show shares her thoughts about our post-Pulse world.
This is Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Hi, I'm Max, a youth participant in Outcasting's main studio in Westchester County, New York. On this edition, Brianna revisits the topic of the massacre at the Pulse nightclub in Orlando, Florida on June 12, 2016, and discusses events that have affected the LGBTQ community in the year that has passed.
A little over a year ago, the largest shooting on American soil took place in Orlando, Florida. On June 12, 2016, between the hours of 2 and 5 a.m., 49 people died and 58 were injured during an attack at Pulse, a gay nightclub. The LGBTQ community was in shock, and the media ran the story for days, focusing on possible connections between the shooter and terrorist organizations. I wrote a piece last year that shared my feelings surrounding what happened at Pulse and how the mainstream media portrayed it. It's been a turbulent 14 months, so I think it's beneficial to look at what's changed in our community, what might change in the future, and how those changes affect us. Not much has changed in how mainstream media treats the attack on Pulse, except that there isn't much of it anymore. The only memorials for Pulse victims I have seen have come from the LGBTQ community. There is nothing I have seen in mainstream media that has addressed the anniversary of that night. The media coverage on this attack was short and filled with talk of ISIS-fueled terrorism, with only a few placing emphasis on the LGBTQ aspect of the shooting. These circumstances remind me of the upstairs lounge fire, which, until the Pulse massacre, had been the most deadly anti-LGBTQ attack in American history. The fire at the Upstairs Lounge, located in New Orleans, Louisiana, killed 32 people in 1973 and received national news coverage for only 3 days. And once the media found out that it had been a gay bar, the coverage took on a horrendously derogatory tone. While coverage of the Pulse massacre hasn't been as directly homophobic as the coverage for the Upstairs Lounge, mainstream media has largely omitted that it was a gay nightclub and that homophobia was almost certainly the shooter's motivation. In addition to the horrifying Pulse shooting, there have been a lot of upsetting changes in the past year. For me, the largest and most worrying change that occurred in the past year was our change in administration. I refer, of course, to the 2016 presidential election. It was hands down the most divisive, confusing, and stressful election we've had, at least in my memory. From rumors of Russian interference to a now victorious candidate with a habit of contradicting not only everything he's ever said, but everything his aides and surrogates have said, the election alone was exhausting. For the longest time, it was impossible to tell exactly what President Trump's position on LGBTQ issues was, but his opinions were made clear in a series of tweets on July 26th. Claiming to have consulted with military leaders, President Trump announced that the United States government will not accept or allow transgender individuals to serve in any capacity in the U.S. military. Trump stated that the military cannot be burdened with the tremendous medical costs and disruption that transgenders in the military would entail. On the campaign trail, Trump proudly declared that he would be protecting the rights of LGBTQ citizens, but this seems to be another campaign promise he's forgotten. The decision to ban transgender people from the military doesn't make sense if you use medical costs to justify it, as Trump did. According to the Rand Corporation's research, transition-related medical procedures raise defense health costs by roughly 0.04 to 0.13%. That amount is so small that it's laughable the president is so concerned about it, especially when you consider that the military spends about 10 times as much money on medication for erectile dysfunction, according to PolitiFact. And if Trump were really so concerned about taxpayers' money and how it is used, he wouldn't take any more trips down to Mar-a-Lago, which have already cost taxpayers millions of dollars, according to multiple sources. While he continues his attempts to undo everything put in place during Barack Obama's time as president, President Trump has cemented his stance against the transgender community. In doing so, he has made clear his opinion of the LGB part of the community as well. In addition to the announcement that transgender service members could soon be fired, the Trump administration has recently been taking an even more anti-LGBTQ tone. The Department of Justice, under the leadership of Attorney General Jeff Sessions, has argued that sexual orientation discrimination is not covered by the Civil Rights Act of 1964. Despite the U.S. Equal Employment Opportunity Commission's published position, the Department of Justice does not believe that discrimination based on sexual orientation is sex discrimination. President Trump has also recently appointed Sam Brownback to be Ambassador of Religious Freedom, a position responsible for promoting religious freedom as an element of U.S. foreign policy. Sam Brownback has been historically anti-LGBTQ, opposing same-sex marriage and signing state legislation to exclude LGBTQ university students while he was governor of Kansas. He uses religion as a conduit to encourage traditional marriage between a man and woman, a view that seems out of place for someone who is meant to be promoting freedom of religion. Meanwhile, Vice President Mike Pence's views are clear. As governor of Indiana, he pushed the Religious Freedom Restoration Act, which allowed businesses the right to refuse services to LGBTQ people. In addition, Pence's crusade against Planned Parenthood, his opposition of needle exchange programs, and his documented desire to divert money intended for HIV prevention to organizations providing conversion therapy led to an outbreak of HIV in Scott County. He has also said that gay couples signal societal collapse, opposed a law that would prohibit workplace discrimination against LGBTQ people, rejected a directive that would allow transgender students to use the bathroom of the gender they identify with, opposed the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and more. In February of 2016, Justice Antonin Scalia died, leaving an empty seat on the Supreme Court. Following his death, Senate Republicans vowed to block President Obama's Supreme Court nomination until a new president took office. President Trump's Supreme Court pick, Neil Gorsuch, has already taken an extremely anti-LGBTQ stance. Gorsuch made clear in his 2004 philosophy dissertation for Oxford University that he did not believe the Constitution protected the right for same-sex couples to marry. It's unclear whether or not his opinions have changed over time. Rumors have been flying for months that Justice Kennedy, so often the court's most influential swing vote, will retire in the coming year. If Kennedy retires, President Trump will be able to nominate another judge for the Supreme Court, and could very well nominate a more conservative judge. This could mean decades of conservative domination in the nation's highest court, a nightmare for LGBTQ individuals whose rights could be severely threatened. Right now, things are not looking good for the future of the LGBTQ community under the Trump administration. Looking at the views of these leaders, we can expect attacks on our rights to become more common. We will almost certainly see attempts from this administration to push us back into silence, back into our closets. But I know the LGBTQ community. I know we will not tolerate these attacks. We will fight tooth and nail to keep everything that we have won through decades of relentless activism. The last year has been full of surprises and shocking political developments. It has been full of scandal and controversy. The year ahead of us will likely be the same. We cannot get tired. We cannot stop fighting for each other. If the world seems to forget us the way they have forgotten the victims of Pulse, then we must do what we have always done and continue to defend this community. And we must continue to demand equality for every member of the community.
Thanks for listening to Outcasting Overtime, a special feature from Outcasting, Public Radio's LGBTQ youth program. Outcasting is heard online at outcastingmedia.org, on iTunes, and on more than 50 public radio stations around the country. Outcasting Overtime is a production of Media for the Public Good, a nonprofit organization. Visit us at outcastingmedia.org to get information about Outcasting, watch Outcasting videos, access our social media links, and listen to the show. Thanks, and thanks for listening.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy.
The BBC's live July 30th I Feel Love concert marked a UK legal milestone, the 50th anniversary of the Sexual Offences Act, which partially decriminalized private consensual adult same-gender sex. Trailblazing singer-songwriter Tom Robinson was among the featured entertainers, and he sang an updated version of his classic anthem, Glad to Be Gay, a song the same BBC had banned when it came out in 1978. A couple of days before the big show, Robinson paid a visit to Gay Star News and treated them to an exclusive acoustic preview, adding some new lyrics at the end.
Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Just sing if you're happy that way. For 42 years now I've fought for the right for people to love just whoever they like. Today we can laugh as we march to the park, and Clause 28's been consigned to the past. Well, if gay liberation means freedom for all, a label is no liberation at all. Bisexual, lesbian, flexible, straight, we're here and we're human and all happy to say. Sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy that way. Hey, sing if you're glad to be gay. Sing if you're happy this way.
Thanks for tuning in to This Way Out, the international LGBT radio magazine brought to you by the nonprofit Overnight Productions. This week's program material came from Francis O'Brien and Wenzel Jones, produced by Steve Pride, Janet Mason, and Outcasters Max and Brianna, produced by Mark Sophos. Bronski Beat, David Brown, and Tom Robinson performed some of the music you heard, and Kim Wilson composed and performed our theme music. This Way Out thanks the Kicking Assets Fund of the Tides Foundation, the Ivana Foundation, the estate of Christopher David Trentum, our contributing affiliate stations, and you, our listener donors, for making this program possible. Email tworadio@aol.com or write to us at P.O. Box 1065, Los Angeles, California 90078, USA. For Associate Producer Lucia Chappell and everyone at This Way Out, I'm Greg Gordon. Thanks for listening online at thiswayout.org and on KLAI Raytonville, California, WLRI Christiana, Pennsylvania, 2NSB Chatswood, New South Wales, and more than 200 other stations around the world, including this community radio station. Stay tuned.